This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Even those of us who have never set foot on the continent of Africa recognize the importance of protecting its wildlife from extinction. The question is, how do we do it? We'll hear a couple of different answers to that question on this Earth Day. Journalist Raymond Bonner makes the case that Western wildlife conservation groups are practicing eco-colonialism by projecting Western attitudes onto African cultures. After living in Kenya for 4 years, Bonner has completed his book At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. Bonner is a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times and is the author of books criticizing American policy toward El Salvador and the Philippines. In 1989, the member nations of the Convention of International Trade in Endangered Species, known by the acronym CITES, declared the elephant endangered and banned all trade in ivory. Although Bonner opposes the ban now, he supported it when he moved to Africa. I asked him why he had supported it.
Why? I suppose I did for the same reason most Americans did, most Westerners did, who'd never spent any time in Africa. A love for the animals, a caring, a desire to save them, thinking they're extraordinary and we really have to save the elephants, and that it seemed horrible to see them killed for their tusks. One of the very first weekends I was in Africa, we went on a safari and we went up to near where George Adamson lived, who was the lion man, of course. And we went out and we saw these poached elephants, and I was sickened. I mean, they'd been slaughtered, their tusks had been cut off, and I thought we have to have an ivory ban. We have to stop ivory trading. I think it was a knee-jerk, typical knee-jerk, soft-hearted liberal approach. But the longer I was there, the more I began to realize that it was not an issue that was so simple. It was not really black and white. The elephants do cause damage to people, like this letter I read from this woman. I met more and more people whose property was damaged by elephants, and I began to realize that banning ivory was not going to save the elephant. And I saw programs in other countries that are working, positive programs like in Zimbabwe, like in Namibia, where they are protecting against poaching, and they were doing it before there was an ivory ban.
Do you support ivory trading now?
With a heavy heart, I think, it's not a very comfortable thought that we're going to commercialize elephants, if you will, that we're going to make money from selling ivory. It's not a very pleasant thought. But neither is the poverty of Africa a very pleasant thought. And that a continent that has very few resources, one of the resources is wildlife. And the question is, how do you give that wildlife an economic value so that people have an incentive to save it? Now, that might not be a very nice way to put it. But if you're a conservationist and we want to save the wildlife, whether it's the rhinoceros, the elephant, the lion, whatever, we're going to have to come up with new approaches. And one way to save the wildlife is to give it an economic value. I can tell you in Zimbabwe, where they have programs where the local people, the people who live in the rural areas, the people who are affected by the wildlife, whose lives are affected on a daily basis by the wildlife, they are now making money from the wildlife. They have a real incentive. They turn in poachers. Look, if an elephant, let's say an elephant, you're going to make money from selling the ivory from 3% of your elephant population. 3% of the elephant population means the population is going to remain stable. It's not going to be threatened. And let's say that brings in, the amount of money that brings in to some rural villages is an extraordinary amount of money for that rural village. And those people are then going to say, wait a minute, we're not going to allow poachers to come in here and take off our elephants. That's like robbing our bank. Those elephants are our assets. We're not going to let poachers kill them.
But wouldn't ivory hunters kill even more elephants than poachers would, endangering the species even more?
No, it's controlled. For example, in Zimbabwe, they would allow an offtake of 3% of the population. Sure, there's going to be crooks, but you've got crooks out there robbing banks, too. That doesn't mean we shut down banks and don't have banks. You have effective law enforcement. The only place you needed an ivory ban, the only place poaching was out of hand, by the way, was in Kenya and Tanzania. And why? Because of corruption and mismanagement. The ivory ban probably was needed in Kenya and Tanzania, but it was needed because of corruption and mismanagement. And rather than address those long-range problems, we took the easy solution, which was to impose a total ban on ivory. The elephant isn't threatened in Zimbabwe. There's 50,000 elephants in Zimbabwe, a country the size of California, by the way. Can you imagine 50,000 grizzly bears in California? 50,000 elephants in Zimbabwe, which is more than they had 10 years ago. Probably 60,000 elephants in Botswana, which is more than they had 10 years ago. Poaching isn't a problem there. The way to deal with poaching is effective law enforcement.
So do you think that the Western approach to conservation is effectively punishing Africans?
Yes, of course it's punishing Africans. It's saying, basically the Western approach to conservation in Africa is saying this: we consider the animals and the land to be a world heritage, but you're going to pay the cost of protecting it, because the West isn't putting in the money to protect these places, directly or indirectly. It's not allowing the Africans to make money off the wildlife, to receive benefits from the wildlife. So they're the ones who are having to pay the cost. It's the cost in damaged property, in damage to their crops, in loss of life.
Well, you mentioned tourism and hunting, and you say that Westerners have always put a lot of stake in tourism, but you're actually thinking a lot about hunting as a way to help the conservation of wildlife, which sounds like a contradiction, but obviously you don't think it is. So explain how hunting could help preservation of wildlife.
Again, it does sound like a contradiction, and again, it's not something I feel very comfortable about. I was forced to examine a lot of my preconceptions mm-hmm. about wildlife and about conservation. I really was while I was in Africa. I'm not a hunter. It's not too strong to say I deplore hunting. I literally have never picked up a rifle and shot an animal. I grew up in Minnesota, but my father never considered it was a rite of passage to hunt. All my friends were hunters, but I never went hunting, and I never felt I lost anything because of it. I thought hunters were, frankly, a lower form of the species and probably not worth saving from extinction. But the longer I was in Africa, I began to have to think, now, what do we want? What are we after? We're after trying to save the wildlife, to make sure that the rhino and the elephant, the lion, the giraffe, doesn't go extinct. And hunting may be the best form of conservation, because hunters, they bring in a lot more money than tourists does. A hunting safari brings in $50,000, let's say, per person. You can go on a photographic safari for about $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000. The head of the wildlife department in Tanzania once told me, he said, I figure one hunter is worth 100 non-hunters. Again, it's not a very comfortable thought, but I think we're going to have to examine and deal with and confront some of our preconceptions about conservation if we're truly going to save the wildlife. And if you ask conservationists seriously and privately, when they don't have to face what they know is popular public opinion, they'll tell you these things. They didn't think the ivory ban was a good idea. You couldn't find one conservationist in Africa when the ivory ban was proposed, who thought it was a good idea. I was researching my book then, starting it. So I was interviewing these people long before the idea became so popular in the West. They were all opposed to it. And if you talk to them, they'll tell you privately they think hunting is a good idea. Even there's a guy I talk about in the book, Esmond Bradley Martin, who has probably led the movement to save the rhino. I mean, internationally, he's the person most responsible for saving the rhino. He's done incredible work. I mean, Esmond Bradley Martin has said if you could sell a rhino for $50,000, a hunting license, it might be worth it, because then we could plow the money back into conservation. It's a horrible thought, but it's even a worse thought that these animals might disappear.
My guest is journalist Raymond Bonner. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Ray Bonner, author of the new book, At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. You've been critical of some conservation groups for the way they raised money through the ban on ivory trading. Can you elaborate on some of your criticisms of that?
Sure. It's in some ways quite simple. There was not, as I said earlier, there was not a single conservation at the time the ban was proposed that thought it was a good idea. And then public emotion, the groundswell of public emotion, and the amount of money that came in for being in favor of the ivory ban was so great that they switched their positions. Take the World Wildlife Fund, which is the largest wildlife conservation organization in the world. At WWF US, the US chapter of the World Wildlife Fund, all the conservationists who had any experience in Africa were opposed to the ban, and the fundraisers were in favor of it. And they let public emotion and fundraising considerations overcome good science and good conservation. The African Wildlife Foundation, which was one of the leaders in the movement to ban ivory, when it was proposed to them in early 1988, they didn't even want a total ban. They were the ones that first called for a boycott on buying ivory, a voluntary consumer boycott. They didn't want people to buy ivory, which was fine. But I have to tell you, even the Africans didn't like that. And that's something we can come back to. I mean, the Africans never wanted an ivory ban. The majority of the African countries, with a majority of the continent's elephants, opposed an ivory ban to the bitter end. So this was something that was imposed by Western conservation values.
You've talked a little bit about the conflicts between development and conservation in Africa. Your book also deals with conflicts between traditional conservationists and animal rights activists. What are the fundamental differences between those two groups?
The fundamental difference is the animal rights groups want to save every single animal, and the more traditional conservationists want to save ecosystems. I remember talking to a conservationist in Zimbabwe who worked for the World Wildlife Fund. He said, that's the fundamental difference between us. They want to save every single animal, and we realize you can't, if you want to save ecosystems, you can't save every animal. Take the elephant, for example. There are too many elephants in Amboseli Park in Kenya. It's 700 or 800, which isn't very many, but it's a very small park. If you go through Amboseli, it looks like, tourists sometimes refer to it as a tree holocaust. It looks like somebody's gone through with a flamethrower. The trees are destroyed. They're dead because of elephants. You know, elephants either knock over saplings or they pull up little bigger trees or they rub their tusks against trees and the trees die. And because the trees have died, the habitat is gone for a lot of other species. You see hardly any giraffe, hardly any reed buck, hardly any monkeys in Amboseli anymore because the elephants have destroyed their habitat. So it's an ecosystem thing. You can't have all the elephants that you want and also have other animals as well. And the animal rights people tend not to see this. And also the thing is, they tend to focus only on animals without thinking about people. I mean, the number of groups after the ivory ban that was put into effect and said, including the African Wildlife Foundation, that said victory for the elephants. Well, victory for the elephants, perhaps, but as I say in the book, what about the people of Africa? Was it a victory for them? No, it was a defeat for them. If you ask Africans, they considered that a defeat.
Have you been rethinking your stand on conservation in the United States?
No, I don't think it's, well, I hope I'm always thinking, but I mean, I don't, to say that we should allow, let's say, for example, trading in ivory, or allow sustainable utilization, the utilization of wildlife in Africa, is not the same as to say that we should sacrifice the spotted owl to the timber industry. The difference is this. In America, we already have, obviously, the highest standard of living in the world. And when we cut down more trees or dam more rivers or take away the habitat of more species, we're doing it to have an even higher standard of living so that we can have more and bigger houses or more furniture from timber, or we dam rivers so that we can have more hydroelectric power so that we can run more air conditioners and more refrigerators and more electronic gear. So in America, we're making sacrifices of the environment for an even higher standard of living. In Africa, some sacrifices are going to have to be made of the wildlife. It's a matter of survival so that they have a dignified standard of living.
In your acknowledgments, you thank your agent for not letting you quit writing this book. What was making you consider quitting?
It was tough. It was a hard book to write. Different, I suppose, than the other books I've written. Let's face it, Terry, it's easier to criticize governments than it is to criticize non-governmental organizations mm-hmm. that are considered to be on the side of the angels. So, I mean, it was tough. It was a harder book to write, perhaps because the subject was a new one for me, and it wasn't just straight government policy. I mean, I tried to capture some of the majesty, the beauty of Africa, the feel of Africa, and places like the Serengeti, and again, you know, the chapter in the book about the Serengeti and what's happened to the Maasai. I mean, there's another classic situation. I mean, go to the Serengeti and Ngorongoro. I mean, they are two of the most staggering places in the world. They are really spiritually, religiously, in any way you want, moving. You stand in the bowl of Ngorongoro, this 100-mile, square-mile bowl. I mean, it's the size of Manhattan. natural zoo. Absolute beauty. The Serengeti, a place the size of Connecticut. It's just moving to be in there and to see the wildlife and almost and nothing else for miles. And I mean, sometimes, as I say, it's the size of Connecticut, and you swear you could see from New Haven to Hartford. I mean, it's so wide open. But look, those are great parks, and we love to go there, and Westerners go there. The Maasai lost their land to make those parks, and they are suffering. I mean, what the Maasai are going through now, I mean, they're living in absolute poverty. They're not getting any benefits. They got tossed off the lands back in the 1950s to make these parks pristine. What are the Maasai getting out of it? You know, as I call that chapter, whose heritage is it? Is it ours? Is it the world? Or does it belong to the people of Africa?
Raymond Bonner is the author of At the Hand of Man, Peril and Hope for Africa's Wildlife. The World Wildlife Fund is the world's largest conservation organization. We call Jeanette Hemley, director of the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Program. She's read Bonner's book and says he's overlooked some fundamental points.
Some of those relate to the very reasons elephants are now recovering, and that is because the ivory trade ban that he argues was not a good idea has actually helped save elephants. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a conservationist anywhere in the world who would not agree with that today.
Let me get to a couple of the main points he makes in his book and that he made in our interview. He says that a lot of Western-based conservation groups aren't taking into account the economic needs and the economic development of African people. Do you agree with that?
No, I disagree completely. In fact, if there's one thing that World Wildlife has learned during its 30 years of global conservation efforts is that conservation will not be successful unless you incorporate and address human needs. We're doing that throughout Africa, throughout Asia, Latin America, wherever we work. In fact, we launched a program in 1985 called Wildlands and Human Needs, which specifically is set out to address combining sustainable development with resource protection. And that was certainly a very big factor in our discussions and concern over the survival of the elephant and the discussion over the ivory trade ban and during that debate.
I know Bonner thinks that there needs to be an economic incentive for African people to practice wildlife conservation. He says hungry Africans aren't going to tolerate the damage elephants wreak if they don't get some economic benefit from the animal. And that's one of the reasons why he opposes the ban on ivory trading, because ivory trading gives a reason for preservation. You're making money from the elephants.
Well, I think it's important to look at the facts that surrounded this whole issue in the mid and late 80s when there was a virtual crisis going on in Africa. What was going on is that elephants were declining in rapid numbers throughout the 1980s. They were being killed on the order of 1,000 to 2,000 per week. 90% of the ivory that was leaving Africa was from illegal sources. The argument and the point about economic incentive to conserve wildlife and protect natural resources is something we certainly agree with completely. But when you look at the particular situation surrounding the African elephant and that debate, local people were not benefiting overall from the ivory trade. And that's what we and the countries that debated this issue through the International Trade Convention called CITES, which ultimately did impose the ivory trade ban in 1989, decided.
Several wildlife conservation groups waged big campaigns to save the elephants of Africa. And the campaign to save the elephants included fundraising campaigns to help the wildlife groups save the elephants. Ray Bonner says that wildlife groups exaggerated the threat of elephant extinction because it was an effective tool to raise money.
Well, elephants were certainly part of our fundraising agenda here at World Wildlife Fund, but simply because there was a conservation imperative. As I said, there was a major crisis going on in Africa. He ignores is the fact that here at World Wildlife Fund, I mean, our fundraisers made it clear that they would adopt whatever approach the program and field experts said was most appropriate. And overall, Another fact that Raymond Bonner ignores is that in the late 80s, between 1987 and 1990 here at World Wildlife Fund, less than 4% of World Wildlife Fund's membership income came from fundraising appeals focusing on elephants. I mean, we have a very big agenda. There are endangered species crises all over the world, ranging from the destruction of the Amazon rainforest to the protection of the snow leopards in Nepal and in the Himalayas. Elephants were part of that indeed, but again, they were only a small part of our overall agenda. But that part of the agenda was important because elephants were dropping. As I said, their numbers were declining at rates up to 2,000 animals being poached per week. And so that was a virtual crisis.
What about the countries that still have a lot of elephants or perhaps even an overpopulation of elephants? Does it make sense to support the ivory trade in countries that still have very large populations of elephants? You know, we're decreasing populations of elephants isn't a problem.
Well, that is certainly one of the issues that was discussed and reviewed during the debate. We've looked long and hard at it. And I think the complication is that the trade control structure that would be developed to ensure that no illegal ivory would leak into trade if you did allow some trade from countries that do have large numbers of elephants is simply not there yet. And one of the problems that complicated the whole elephant ivory trade issue during the 1980s that became very clear to us after a lot of analyses of trade data and poaching data is there was a tremendous amount of laundering of ivory going on in the sense that elephant ivory taken in a country where the elephant is completely protected was shipped through countries that have a more open export policy and laundered through illegally. Now, if there were a way that you could develop a system that would ensure that wouldn't happen, I think we'd be, you know, on a whole different discussion now. But that has not yet happened, and until it happens through CITES, I think we really must hold the ivory trade moratorium in place to ensure that elephants as a whole are protected throughout Africa.
Jeanette Hemley directs the Wildlife Trade Monitoring Program of the World Wildlife Fund. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.